possible. Chapter 21. Millions of Mirrors. No one can make you feel inferior without your consent. Eleanor Roosevelt, activist, feminist, superhero, longest-serving First Lady of the United States ever. One of the most staggering things about other people is that they provide us with valuable and often alarmingly intimate information about who they are as soon as we meet them. If we pay attention, we can pick up on the major clues they're sending out through their body language, their appearance, their lifestyle, their actions, their interests, their words, how they treat their dogs, the waitress, themselves, etc. Some people let it all hang out for everyone to see right away. Others let it seep out in little spurts. I love water skiing. I admire how confident you are about your weight problem. I just got out of prison, etc. With the exception of the sociopath or the skilled pathological liar, the majority of humanity gives us plenty to chew on right out of the gate. All of this information then goes through the filter of who we are, and depending on our perceptions and judgments and hang-ups and number of years spent in therapy, we decide if the person is someone we want to get to know better or not. We're all attracted to, as well as turned off by, various things about other people. And the things that stand out the most to us are the things that remind us the most of ourselves. This is because other people are like mirrors for us. If somebody bugs you, you're projecting onto them something you don't like about yourself. And if you think they're awesome, they're reflecting back something that you see in yourself that you like, even if it's not developed in you yet. I know this sounds like I'm making a massive generalization, but just stay with me here. Your reality is created by what you focus on and how you choose to interpret it. This goes for everything, including the things you focus on about the people in your world. For example, depending on who you are, you could react in a myriad of different ways to your new boyfriend or girlfriend constantly referring to you as the giant dumbass. You could A, see this as a red flag and think they're a bully. B, see this as a red flag and think they're nervous or insecure and have terrible manners. C, see this as a green light because they're in so much pain that they need to abuse other people. They really need someone as understanding as I am. D, see this as a green light because you believe that you are, in fact, a giant dumbass. Or E, think it's hilarious because it doesn't resonate with you. The people you surround yourself with are excellent mirrors for who you are and how much or how little you love yourself. We attract people into our lives for a reason, just as they attract us into theirs. We all help each other grow and figure out our issues if we seize the opportunity to learn from, instead of just react to, by getting defensive or justifying our actions or whining about, the highly irritating things other people do. It's our annoying friends or family members or clients or neighbors or lady on the train with a voice like a bullhorn who help us grow and see who we truly are, even more than our beloved BFFs do, unless they're being momentarily annoying, and then we can thank them too. Don't miss the glorious opportunity to learn that's being handed to you by the person whose mouth you'd really love to stick your fist in. The things that bother us about other people bother us because they remind us of something we don't like about ourselves. Or their behavior triggers a fear or insecurity that we have, but may not realize we have. For the longest time, one of my big stories was that being feminine was weak and annoying. Somewhere along the way, I decided that it wasn't cool or powerful to act like, or be, a girl, and my feminine self became part of me that I was ashamed of. Hence, I was much less threatened by women who came at me with a power drill than women who came at me with an eyebrow pencil, which is why it's pretty hilarious to me still that one of my best friends is as girly as they get. I met her when we were working together in New York City and was instantly drawn to her because she's hilariously brilliant and sweet and did a flawless impression of one of our coworkers walking down the hall with his ass sticking out that always left me doubled over, clinging to furniture. Unlike me, however, she's a lover of girls' nights out and mani-pedi dates, an eager ogler of engagement rings when summoned by the fluttering hand of a soon-to-be bride, and a pro at the girly girl gang greeting. Arms raised high in the air, head back, eyes squeezed shut, high-pitched, "Oh my God!" for all to hear. For this, we call her Pink. A decade later, I'm living in Los Angeles, and Pink is living outside New York City, married with a bunch of kids. Natch. When she decides to take her first solo vacation since becoming a mom and heads to San Diego to see her best friend from college, she calls and begs me to drive down to see her. I agree, somewhat begrudgingly. It wasn't the 2-hour drive that bothered me, but the best friend from college, who I'd never met but was sure was pinker than pink. I imagined a full-on sorority scene, complete with painting our toenails while having a Meg Ryan movie fest and talking about how fat we'd gotten. But I love Pink, so off I went. Meanwhile, down in San Diego, Pink's best friend from college is less than thrilled at the prospect of Pink's best gal pal from her New York City days driving down from L.A. Her eyes were also rolling at the potential estrogen bomb, so imagine our delight when we discovered that we were both equally as macho. Once we realized that the playing field wasn't as overwhelmingly pink as we feared it would be, however, we got the biggest surprise of all. Our inner, neglected girls felt safe to come out of hiding. All three of us lost our voices that weekend, cackling and screaming, "Oh my God!" for all to hear. I wouldn't be surprised if a toenail or two even got painted. Don't remember. Was too drunk on wine spritzers. I'm still not the most enthused member of a bridal shower, and I'm not saying that you have to come around and like everything in this world that bothers you, but I am saying that if you actively don't like something, it's because it resonates with you on some level. It has meaning to you. When you find yourself dealing with someone who irritates you, and you find yourself getting gossipy, finger-pointy, judgy, or complainy, rising up and confronting the situation can do a hell of a lot more than just make your life more pleasant in the long run. It can help you heal and grow and get out of victim mode, because it forces you to deal with the gnarlier aspects of yourself, the parts that make you not so proud. None of us care to admit that we're dishonest, conceited, insecure, unethical, mean, bossy, stupid, lazy, etc. But that's what attracted you to the people you notice it in, and them to you, in the first place. And admitting it is the first step in letting it go. If people are annoying in a way that has nothing to do with us, we either don't notice it or we don't get that hung up on it. For example, say there's someone in your life who you find to be an insufferable know-it-all. Every time you open your mouth to talk about something you did, she says she's already done it. Anything you know, she already knows and knows much more about. And she has to make sure you and everyone within a 10-mile radius knows how much more she knows about it. While you find yourself entertaining fantasies about putting her head through the wall every time you're around her, someone else might be hanging on her every word, unable to get enough of her fascinating and brilliant conversation. The reason she makes you so crazy is because you most likely are a know-it-all yourself, or you worry that you are one, or you have insecurities about people thinking you know nothing. Our reality is a mirror of our thoughts, the people in our reality included. Same thing goes with what people throw at us. Would you be offended if someone kept making fun of how short you were if you were 6 feet tall? It most likely wouldn't even register. Or if it did, you'd just think they were kind of strange. But if they teased you about being bossy, and deep down you feared you were, it would definitely get your attention. It would also mean they have energy around their own bossiness if they're recognizing it in you, but that's not your problem. What you focus on, you create more of in your life. If you're consciously or subconsciously focused on certain beliefs about who you are, or who you want to be, or who you do not want to be, you will attract people who mirror those traits right back at you. This is why, when you're dealing with a backstabbing quote-unquote friend, or some sort of toxic person that you need to stand up to or kick out of your life, you get caught up in this self-inflicted trap of not wanting to hurt the other person, or latching onto their finer qualities, or fearing the worst if you don't put up with their crap. I don't care how long you've been friends with someone, or how sorry you feel for them, or how they really helped you those 8 million times, or how hilarious, successful, hot, inspiring, desperate, scary, connected, brilliant, or helpless they are, because the reason you're having trouble standing up to them isn't about any of that. What's really going on is you're being faced with rewiring your limiting beliefs about yourself, and you're using these excuses for these other people to avoid facing your own issues around sticking up for yourself. At the end of the day, it's not about them. It's about you believing you're worthy of being loved and seen for who you really are. When we agree to let ourselves down in favor of supporting the bad behavior of others, it often stems from the same impulse. We're unwilling to make other people more uncomfortable than they just made us. Not terribly studly in the old self-love department, is it? By making them uncomfortable, I mean declining to participate in their drama, by the way, not by being equally abusive back. This isn't about getting an eye for an eye and sinking to a lower level. It's about standing up for your highest self, no matter if the person you're dealing with should choose to have the experience of feeling disappointed, feeling hurt, feeling inconvenienced, seeing you as a crazy person. It's about respecting yourself instead of catering to your insecure need to be liked. This is incredibly powerful because when you love yourself enough to stand in your truth, no matter what the cost, everyone benefits. You start attracting the kinds of things, people, and opportunities that are in alignment with who you truly are, which is way more fun than hanging out with a bunch of irritating energy suckers. And by declining to participate in other people's drama, i.e., refusing to rip people to shreds, to complain about how unfair the world is, etc., you not only raise your own frequency, but you offer the drama queens the chance to rise up too, instead of everyone continuing to play a low, lame game. Never apologize for who you are. It lets the whole world down. We all know someone who does not take shit from anyone. Ever. We look upon these types of people with wide-eyed reverence, and would never dream of being stupid enough to present them with any of our own BS or try to make them wrong. Why? Because we respect them and, are usually kind of terrified of them, in a healthy way. And why do we respect them? Because they respect themselves. So how can you get rid of your lame-o projections and judgments and grace the world with your highest, most unapologetic self? 1. Own your ugly. Start noticing the things that drive you nuts about other people, and instead of complaining or judging or getting defensive about them, use them as a mirror. Especially if you find yourself getting really worked up. Get mighty real with yourself. Is this quality something you have yourself? Or is there a certain aspect to it that you're loath to admit is just like you? Or does it remind you of something you're actively trying to suppress or avoid? Or that you're actively doing just the opposite of? Or that you're threatened by? Become fascinated by, instead of furious about, the irritants surrounding you. And go get your learning on. 2. Question your ugly. Once you discover what part of yourself you're projecting onto the person who is presently bugging the living crap out of you, you can start letting it go. Begin by asking yourself some very simple questions and diffusing the limiting and false stories you've been lugging around for ages. For example, if you're all pissed off that your friend who's always late is late again, it's pushing your buttons because you're holding onto some sort of quote-unquote truth about the way people should be with time. Flip it around and ask yourself things like, in what ways am I always late or inconsiderate or unreliable? Or maybe it's, in what ways am I too rigid or controlling? Once you have your answer, ask yourself, who do I need to be for this situation not to bother me? Using this scenario, let's say you discover that you're a lot more rigid than you care to admit. This is very valuable information because now you know that in order to be happier, you need to loosen your bone, Wilma. Stop insisting that people do things exactly the way you do them, especially the people in your life who have proven they most definitely won't. Notice where you're being ridiculously demanding simply because it's become your habit and not because it's really necessary. and constantly ask yourself, "Can I let this one go?" By becoming aware of what we do, we can investigate why we do it and then choose to keep it or drop it, instead of blindly reacting through habit. What am I getting out of being this way? As discussed in Chapter 17, "It's so easy once you figure out it isn't hard," we don't do anything unless we're getting something out of it, even if what we're getting are false benefits. Using this scenario, some of the positive benefits of being rigid are that you're always on time, you get shit done, etc. But there are also some negative advantages to being rigid, too. You intimidate people into getting your way. You get to be right whenever someone messes up, which they'll do often if you've really honed the rigid thing well. You get to be in control, etc. Once you bust yourself on the false reward you're getting from holding on to this behavior, you can see it for what it is, something that's not always in alignment with who you truly are and aspire to be, and release it when it's not working. How would I feel if I wasn't this way? One of the best ways to release the aforementioned lousy behavior is by asking yourself how you'd feel if this wasn't true for you anymore. How would I feel if I took the pull out of my ass about everyone doing everything exactly how I say to do it, all the time, in every circumstance? Ask the question and then imagine yourself as this person who has let it go. How does your body feel? What do you use the brain space for that used to be taken up with poisonous thoughts about the inconsiderate pinheads you're surrounded by who are not following your instructions? Feel into the reality of what it would be like to let this go. Breathe into it. Visualize it. Fall in love with not having it anymore. And then kick it to the curb. 3. Don't be an enabler. In the fuzzier cases where you're not sure what to do, but you really do want to help someone, recognize the difference between helping and enabling. When you reach out a helping hand, do you feel like they're pulling you down or that you're lifting them up towards their potential? Are they grateful or entitled? Do they use your help to actively move themselves in a positive direction, or do they constantly need more, more, more? Just this one last time, for the 50th time. Pay attention and trust how you feel. If you're truly helping them and they're rising to the occasion, it will raise everyone's frequencies and you'll feel good. If you're enabling them, you'll feel heavy, depressed, and eventually resentful. While it's no fun to kick someone to the curb when they're at their lowest low, if you constantly bail them out, they'll never wake up and save themselves. Why should they? They've got you to fund their pity party. Tough love is still love. 4. Give painful people the heave-ho. Sometimes, no matter how much work you do on yourself and how forgiving you are and how skilled you get at letting it go, there's just no way around it. Some people are just too committed to their own dysfunction. They're painful to be around. You'd rather cover yourself in the fleas of 1,000 camels than go out for a cup of coffee with them. This is all about learning and loving and growing into the highest version of yourself, not seeing just how much torture you can endure. So along with understanding how to grow from the not-so-savory behavior of those around you, it's also important to understand how to get the hell away from them if they're chronically self-obsessed or violent or blaming or negative or controlling or jealous or high drama or manipulative or victimized or whiny or pessimistic or mean to animals. Here's how. First, feed your head. As discussed, a lot of times the people we need to kick to the curb happen to be those we love, or at least like a lot, for their decent qualities. Hence, ye olde guilt can really get in our way when trying to do the right thing. So stay strong. See it as being nice to yourself instead of being mean to them. Remembering that you are rising up to the highest version of yourself instead of shrinking down to their level can give you the strength you need to shake them off your leg. Next, hit eject. Another important thing to remember when yanking the weeds out of your garden is not to get involved in their drama. Cut the cord as quickly and simply as possible with little to no discussion. If they're so oblivious to your feelings that you need to toss them out of your life, chances are very good they won't see this coming. So the discussion on why you need to end it could go on for the rest of your lives if you let it. Suddenly get really busy. Fade them out. Wean them off you with zero explanation. The louder they scream, the busier you suddenly get. If having a conversation is unavoidable, remember, you've already decided that you want out, so don't get sucked into working through your decision or their problems with them. Simply say that the relationship isn't working for you, that you don't like how it makes you feel, that you have to end it, and that it's not open for discussion. Make it all about you. Give them nothing to work with or argue about. 5. Love yourself. Fiercely, loyally, unapologetically. Chapter 22. The Sweet Life. It's great to be here. It's great to be anywhere. Keith Richards, rock god, connoisseur of life. I've got a cat who's 22 years old. I've also got a dad who's 87. The cat and my dad share the same superhero power. They both have the ability to make me pay lots of attention to them and be nicer to them than I am to anyone else. Anyone else not staring down the barrel of their impending mortality, that is. I first realized that my cat was old and might die soon about a year ago when, overnight, all his body fat plunged to his belly region, causing him to swing it around like an udder and leaving him with a spine that's still in shock, jutting out all spindly and jagged, wondering where everybody went. This is when the teary farewells started every time I'd leave the house and the fancy wet food began appearing in his bowl. In Dad's case, the phone calls and flights back east have escalated dramatically, and I now laugh hysterically at all his jokes, no doubt making him worry more about my well-being than I do about his. I'm thrilled to report that even though in the calendar's opinion they're real old, they're both still kicking butt. Dad plays tennis once a week and still knows who I am, and my cat still runs when he hears the can opener. They're also excellent reminders. When it comes to the creatures you love and the things you love and the life you love, what on earth could possibly be more important than soaking them up right now while you've still got the opportunity? If it's something you want to do, don't wait until you're less busy or richer or quote-unquote ready or 20 pounds lighter. Start right now. You'll never be this young again. If it's the people you love, visit them as often as possible. Act as if every time you see them will be the last. If they bug you sometimes, love them anyway. If you've got differences, get over them. Don't get so tangled up in the stupid little stuff that you miss out on enjoying the people who have part ownership of your heart. If you're not where you want to be in life, keep going. Treat yourself like you're the closest friend you've got. Celebrate the magnificent creature that you are. Don't let anyone mess with you in your dreams, least of all yourself. Your life is happening right now. Do not snooze and lose. Love yourself while you've still got the chance. Part 5. How to Kick Some Ass. Chapter 23. The Almighty Decision. Until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. The moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. W. H. Murray, Explorer, Mountain Climber, Committer. The story goes that when Henry Ford first came up with the idea for his V8 motor, he wanted the engine to have all 8 cylinders cast in one block. I have no idea what that means, but apparently it was a tall order because his team of engineers was like, "Bitch, you crazy!" He told them to do it anyway, and off they grumbled to toil away at it, only to come back and inform him that it was impossible. Upon hearing this news, Ford told them to keep at it, no matter how long it took. He was all, "I don't want to see your faces until you bring me what I want." And they were all, "We just proved it can't be done." And he was all, "It can't be done, and it will be done." And they were all, "Cannot." And he was all, "Can so." And they were all, "No way." And he was all, "Way." So off they went again, and this time for a whole year, and nothing. So they go back to Ford, and there's lots of tears and finger-pointing and hair-pulling, and Ford sends them off again and tells them it will be done again. And then, in the lab, somewhere between folding origami swans out of their notes and making fart noises every time someone mentions the word Ford, his engineers do the impossible. They discover how to make his 8-cylinder engine block. This is what it means to make a decision for reals. When you make a no-nonsense decision, you sign up fully and keep moving towards your goal regardless of what's flung in your path. And stuff will most definitely get flung, which is why making the decision is so crucial. This shit is not for sissies. The moment it gets hard or expensive or puts you at risk of looking like a moron, if you haven't made the decision, you will quit. If it wasn't uncomfortable, everyone would be out there all in love with their fabulous lives. So often we pretend we've made a decision when what we've really done is signed up to try until it gets too uncomfortable. Henry Ford didn't even make it past the sixth grade, and there he was, bossing around a bunch of the world's biggest engineering smarty pantses, setting himself up to look like a total idiot by spending large amounts of money and time on the proven impossible. Ford was determined, and he trusted his gut and his vision more than the small thinking of others. He'd made the decision that he would have his engine the way he would have it, and nothing was going to stop him. This is why the decision is so important. If you had an idea and had to go up against a room full of people who quote-unquote knew better than you did and demand they do what you say in spite of all the proof they had against you, would you stick to your guns? Or if you needed tens of thousands of dollars to start your new business and the only person you could think of to ask was your scary, rich uncle who never remembered who you were even though you saw him every Christmas, would you ask him for it? Or if you were sick of feeling fat and unsexy and out of shape, and the only time you could make it to the gym was at 5 a.m. on freezing winter mornings when you were all snuggly in bed, would you go? If you made the decision that you were going to reach your goals, you would do whatever it took. If you merely wanted to, but hadn't made the firm decision to, you'd roll over and begin convincing yourself that your life is fine just the way it is. This is where being connected to your desire and source energy and having an unshakable belief in the not yet seen is so critical. There are plenty of times when we get a brilliant idea and it temporarily fails, or it pushes us into unfamiliar territory. If we don't have a strong connection to the truth, we live in an abundant universe, we are awesome, glorious, tear-jerkingly lovable, etc., a blazing desire, and an unflinching belief in our own vision before it's manifested, we'll fall prey to our own fears and everyone else's fears that it's not possible and give up, instead of course-correcting or pushing on through and bringing it to life. As Winston Churchill so aptly explained, success consists of going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. Nobody gets to the top of the mountain without falling on his face over and over again. By the way, back when Henry Ford insisted to a room full of annoyed engineers that his V8 engine could be built the way he envisioned it, it was after he'd already gone bankrupt in his first attempt at creating an automobile empire. So at that time, he already had plenty of proof that he was capable of failing on a massive scale. But his faith in himself and his vision was so strong that he stuck with it, in spite of all the evidence around him that pointed to big fat loser, and became one of the most successful entrepreneurs of all time. Temporary failure is all the rage. All the cool kids have done it. Michael Jordan was cut from his high school basketball team for lack of skill. Steven Spielberg, a high school dropout, was rejected from film school 3 times. Thomas Edison, who was dubbed too stupid to learn anything by a teacher, tried more than 9,000 experiments before successfully creating the light bulb. Soichiro Honda, the founder of Honda Motor Company, was turned down by Toyota for an engineering position, so he started his own damn company. Beethoven's music teacher told him he was talentless, and more specifically, was hopeless at composing. Beethoven turned a deaf ear. I know, so bad, sorry. Fred Smith wrote a paper while at Yale about his big idea for an overnight delivery service. He got a C. He went on to create FedEx anyway. The only failure is quitting. Everything else is just gathering information. There's no big mystery to this stuff. If you want something badly enough and decide that you will get it, you will. You've done it before. You've lost the weight, gotten the job, bought the house, quit the nasty habit, gotten in shape, asked someone out, splurged on the front row tickets, grown out your bangs. You just need to remember that you can do it with anything in your life, even the things that you presently think are out of your reach. There are plenty of people out there in the world living the kind of life you only dream about living, many of whom are far less fabulous and talented than you are. The key to their success is that they decided to go for it. They stopped listening to their tired old excuses, changed their lousy habits, and got the fuck on the fuck. Here's how you can too. 1. Want it bad. You need to have a 10-ton gorilla of desire behind your decision, or else you'll wimp out the second things get hard. It's like people who get hypnotized to quit smoking when they really don't want to quit, or who try to lose weight when they're more excited by pizza than being able to look down and see their feet. It never works. A few months ago, I dragged my ass to yoga class for a solid week, even though I just so did not feel like doing it. I paid my money, sat down on my mat, and was surprised to find my hand raised in the air when the instructor asked if anyone had any injuries she should know about. I then heard myself explaining that I'd just gotten the cast off my broken elbow and should really take it easy. I am an adult. I am very busy. I spent money on that class and then lied so I didn't have to participate. I did have a cast, but it had come off about 8 months earlier. I spent the majority of yoga week quietly napping on my mat and conjuring up my best wincing in pain face in case she was looking at me while I was half-assing down dog. It was ridiculous. If you're going to push through major obstacles to reach your goal, you can't just want to. You need to be in a full-on tizzy of excitement about what it is you're going after and hold onto it like a pit bull. In order to do this, you need to have the audacity to be honest about what you really want to do, not what you should do. Believe it's available to you, regardless of any evidence otherwise, and go for it. 2. Get good at it. To decide literally means to cut off. No wonder so many people are totally freaked out by it. The terror around making the wrong decision can be so overwhelming to some people that they develop the habit of A, waffling back and forth, paralyzed by self-doubt and terror, finally eking out a quote-unquote decision that they then proceed to change over and over and over again, B, making decisions hastily, without thinking or feeling into them, their main goal being to escape the discomfort and get the damn thing over with already, or C, being so afraid that if they pick one thing, they'll miss out on another, so they either choose to do nothing or try to do everything, which are both excellent ways to miss out on all of it. They basically decide to never decide because they don't want to make the wrong decision. Good times! Deciding is freedom. Indecision is torture. Indecision is one of the most popular tricks for staying stuck within the boundaries of what's safe and familiar, which is why a common trait of successful people is that they make decisions quickly and change them slowly. And by quickly, I don't mean that you must know exactly what to do the moment a decision presents itself, although there are those people who do, but rather that you immediately face the damn thing and start working through your decision-making process, whatever that may look like, sleeping on it, making a list of the pros and cons, feeling into it, etc. If you're a waffler, or prefer to avoid the process altogether, a great thing to do is practice on the little things to build up your decision-making muscle. When eating at a restaurant, make yourself pick something off the menu in under 30 seconds. Once you choose, you are authorized to change your mind or your order. Give yourself 20 minutes to go online and research the best garlic press and then make the purchase. Pick things off the shelves at the supermarket in under 10 seconds. Knock yourself out of the habit of being a deer stuck in the headlights by demanding you wake up and choose something. If you're someone who needs to sleep on it or mull it around a bit, give yourself a deadline. Don't leave it open to decide when you'll decide and risk waking up 40 years later, finally sure of what to do, long after the opportunity has passed you by. Pay attention to how much time you need to decide, overnight, a week, a month, and demand of yourself that you figure it out by then. If you're wired for making instant decisions, practice tuning into your intuition and fully trusting what it says, regardless of what your brain may be screaming about. Get quiet, listen for and feel into the answer, and practice acting on your first solid impulse. And whoever you are, please stop saying how pathetic you are at making decisions. Erase the phrase, "I don't know," from your vocabulary, and replace it with, "I'll know what to do soon enough." Decide to become the person who makes quick, smart decisions, and you will. 3. Eliminate the negotiation process. When I decided to quit smoking, if I even toyed with thoughts like, well, what harm will one itty-bitty drag do? I was screwed. Our decisions must be watertight, because excuses will seep through any little cracks in our resolve, and before we know it, we'll be on our asses. Decisions are not up for negotiation. The old you, the one who has not yet decided to kick ass, is in the past. Stay present and do not, even for one second, look backwards or entertain any ideas of straying from your decision. Think only of the new you. The whole point of deciding is to stop wasting time and to move forward, not to spend time figuring out how you can wiggle out of your decision. It helped me to think of it this way. I'm not going to go home and negotiate about whether or not I'm going to smoke a cigarette, just as I'm not going to go home and negotiate about whether or not to snort some horse tranquilizers. I don't negotiate about snorting horse tranquilizers because I'm not a horse tranquilizer snorter. Now that I don't smoke, I'm not going to negotiate about smoking because I don't smoke. 4. Stick like glue. I used to write for an entrepreneurial magazine where I got to interview all these hugely successful business owners. Whenever I asked them what the secret to their success was, the overwhelming majority answered, tenacity. Be the last person standing. Wear down your obstacles and excuses and fears and doubts until they're finally like, you? Again? Jesus H. Christ, fine, here you go. Now get out of my face. Birthing your dreams is like giving birth. Conceiving the idea is the fun part, hopefully. Then you go through insane amounts of fear and excitement and dreaming and planning and vomiting and growing and thinking you're crazy and thinking you're awesome and stretching and shape-shifting until you're practically unrecognizable to everyone, even your own self. Along the way, you clean up your puke and massage your aching back and apologize to all the people whose heads you ripped off in a hormonal killing spree, but you stay the course because you know this baby of yours is going to be the bomb. Then, finally, just when you can see a light at the end of the tunnel, labor starts. Your innards twist and strangle and force you to stumble around hunched over in the shape of the letter C, while you breathe and pray and curse, and just when you think it can't get any more out of your mind painful, a giant baby head squeezes out of a tiny hole in your body. Then, a full-blown miracle appears. In order to change your life and start living a new one that you've never lived before, your faith in miracles and yourself must be greater than your fear. However easy or rough your birth process is, you have to be willing to fall down, get up, look stupid, cry, laugh, make a mess, clean it up, and not stop until you get there, no matter what. 5. Love yourself. You can do anything. Chapter 24. Money, your new best friend. I worked for a menial's hire, only to learn, dismayed, that any wage I asked of life, life would have willingly paid. Anonymous. Many years ago, Los Angeles was hit by a relentless rainstorm, the likes of which I'd never seen in my life. It rained for what seemed like 40 days and 40 nights, nonstop and hard. Rivers overflowed, houses slid down hillsides, bad hair wreaked chaos throughout the most image-conscious city in the world. This was the kind of rain you didn't want to be driving around in anything, let alone a 23-year-old junker convertible with a leaky roof, no grill, a back window that was duct-taped shut, and a front tire that went flat every 3 days. I'd been in the market for a new car for a long time and couldn't find anything I really loved or thought I could afford. But as I sat there in a puddle, driving to the supermarket with a trash bag under my ass and an old T-shirt slammed in the door to keep the leaking to a minimum, it occurred to me that perhaps I should speed up my search. At the time, I didn't have a whole lot of money, but I had my own business that I was trying to grow. The problem was I felt stuck in that place where even though I wanted bigger and better things for myself monetarily, as well as feeling more mighty and self-actualized in general, I was worried that if I raised my prices, I'd lose all my clients and my self-respect, or that I'd get called out as a money-grubbing pig or a fraud who had no right to charge that much. I was also scared that if I went big and grew my business, I wouldn't be able to handle it. I'd have to hire tons of people, spend my time doing things I hated, and get so busy I'd never get to travel again. Basically, that I'd wither and die trapped behind my computer, fun and freedom skidding away in my rearview mirror, never to be seen again. Blah, blah, blah. I could talk for about 4 more hours explaining why I was where I was, but suffice it to say, I was basically playing at the level of someone who drives around in a car like the one I was driving around in. And the most painful part really was that even though all signs pointed to broke, clueless, and stuck, deep down I knew I could be doing so much better. Which is why, even though the sound of crickets could be heard echoing throughout my empty bank account, I wandered into the Audi dealership, took the brand new Q5 for a spin, and let the sales guy rattle on and on about leather this and premium that. In my head, I was thinking, do you have any idea who I am? I'm just taking a fantasy break before heading over to Honda. But in my heart, I knew better. Way down deep, it was about much more than just a damn car. It was about no longer being the kind of person who takes what she can get, and finally becoming the kind of person who creates exactly what she wants. It was large, Marge, and because part of me was terrified to grow, and part of me wanted to blast out and be huge, and also because I love to drive more than I love to eat, I tortured myself over which car to buy for weeks. I finally whittled it down to 2 options. The Honda CR-V, a perfectly excellent little SUV with all the following attributes. Okay gas mileage, a sunroof, room for friends, a comfy ride, a ho-hum stereo, reasonably fun to drive, decently priced. Or the Audi Q5, a stick of butter on 4 wheels with the following attributes. Okay gas mileage, a sunroof that takes up the entire roof of the car, room for friends, big, fat, and tall ones, leather seats you could have a sexual relationship with, a stereo designed by God himself, angels sing when you open the doors, sexy, flashy, expensive, pretentious, terrifying. I came very close to buying the Honda, but as I sat there, test driving it for the 10th time, trying to convince myself that this was the one, I couldn't shake the nagging truth that I was in love with someone else. Buying the Honda would have been the sensible thing to do, but I knew that adventure, true love, and a whole new way of life awaited me on the other side of my comfort zone. Blasting through this comfort zone is what I want to talk about here. Purchasing the Audi should have had me waking up screaming in the middle of the night, because it costs the kind of money I would normally only consider spending on something like mandatory heart surgery, certainly not on something as frivolous as a car. But after I bought it, I slept like a baby. Because once I made the decision to buy it, I also made the decision to get over my shit and become the kind of person who can make the kind of money to buy that kind of car, or who can do anything else I want to do. I almost instantly came up with a way to pay off the Audi, and am certain that if I'd bought the Honda, I'd still be struggling to pay for it. Because I'd still be playing small, I'd still be in the mindset that I can't afford more, that I'm the kind of person who has to struggle to get whatever she can, that I can't break out of my mold and go get something completely, quote-unquote, out of my reach, etc. When you up-level your idea of what's possible and decide to really go for it, you open yourself up to the means to accomplish it as well. I'm not talking about going out and recklessly blowing all your money on stupid crap. I'm talking about expanding your beliefs about what is available to you in all areas of your life. And for the purposes of this chapter, I'm going to focus on what kind of money you believe is here for you to purchase the things and experiences you truly desire. Whether or not the money is currently in your bank account is irrelevant. I didn't have the money either when I bought my new car. When you're available to play a bigger game, i.e., quit your ho-hum job and invest in your own business, buy a new house, send your kids to private school, hire a coach, hire a house cleaner, buy a new mattress, etc., You either need to pay for it with the money you have, or manifest the money if you don't have it already. And manifesting it is going to be pretty damn hard if you insist that not only is it not there for you, but that you aren't the kind of person who could ever make it or pay it off if you borrowed it. In order to transform your life, you may have to spend the money you do have, get a loan, sell something, borrow from a friend, put it on your credit card, or manifest it in some other way. Which is going to go against some pretty deep-seated beliefs we've all been raised with about how going into debt is irresponsible. Unless it's a student loan, of course, because for some reason we've decided in that case, and that case only, it's okay. This is about taking a leap of faith into a new realm that you strongly desire to be in. Demanding of yourself that you rise to the occasion and start living your damn life already. After I took my great leap into luxury car land, I made multiple six figures with my business for the first time ever, began traveling the world on a regular basis, got my third book deal, made huge donations, for me anyway, to causes I'm really passionate about, and helped my clients achieve similar personal bests too. Here's the thing. Making money isn't only about the money. Just as losing weight isn't only about losing weight, and finding your soulmate isn't only about finding your soulmate. It's about who you become and what you believe is possible for yourself. Money is currency, and currency is energy. As we've discussed, we live in a universe that is vibrating with energy. Our universe is abundant, and everything you desire is here, in this moment, waiting for you to shift your perception and your energy and receive it, money included. Money is energy like anything else. And when you're operating at a high frequency with no resistance to it and take right action, you can manifest the money you desire. We all know that we have to work to make money. We've been taught that all our lives. But what we're not taught is that we must also align our energy with the financial abundance we seek. In other words, act as if you're where you want to be. Don't hang out with sad sacks and people who whine about how broke they are all the time. Erase the words "I can't" from your vocabulary. Envision what you desire, set goals, and demand of yourself that you become who you need to become to create the life you desire. Our relationship to money is just as important as the action we take to manifest it, which is one reason why so many people who work their asses off their whole lives, but who have lousy energy around money, are left wondering why they have nothing to show for it. Here's a little one-sided dialogue that may or may not sound familiar to you. Yay! I think you're fun to hang out with, too! Wait, what? You think I'm the root of all evil? How can you say that? All you talk about is how you wish you had more of me, even though you're scared to admit you like me. And you say I'm not there for you. And you think people who like me are greedy pigs. Yet you get so ecstatic whenever I show up. And you work so hard to get me to come over. But I keep you in a constant state of worry. And you hate dealing with me. And no matter what I do, it's never enough. One minute you act like you'll die without me, and the next I make you feel like a filthy whore. You know what? I'm done. See you later, freak. Considering that this, or some version of this, is the sort of relationship most people have with money, I don't think the question is, why can't we make the kind of money we want? I think the better question is, how the hell do we expect to? Most people have such conflicted feelings around money that they turn it into a full-on circus, rivaled only by the equally popular freak shows surrounding religion and sex. All three are crammed to the brim with issues and anxieties and staunch fight-to-the-death beliefs that cause them to bring so much sadness to the world. Meanwhile, if everyone would just chill out, sex, money, and religion could be the leading causes of joy. Silly, ain't we? In order to bring money joyfully into our lives, we have to understand that we're having a relationship with it, and then treat it like any other important and meaningful relationship. We need to pay attention to it, want it, nurture it, put effort into it, respect it, cherish it, love it, etc. Ridding yourself of your fear and loathing of money, be it conscious or subconscious, is essential if you want to make any. I was extremely poverty proud for so long. I felt I was so much nobler in my pursuit of art and fun and altruism than those people who wasted their lives just going after money. No way in hell was I going to sacrifice my awesome life just to chase the filthy dollar. No, instead I was going to choose between having health insurance or a place to live. I was going to spend precious time that I could have spent making money driving an extra 30 blocks to the gas station where I could save 3 cents a gallon, sifting through piles of clothes in search of the gems at Goodwill, clipping coupons, hunting down sales, researching which bars had free food at happy hour. Productive things like that. In my quest to make money an inconsequential part of my life, I was basically thinking about it more than anyone who actually had money ever thought about it. What I didn't realize was that it's not an either-or situation. I could make great money and keep my integrity and have more fun and make more art and help more people and make a bigger difference in the world. Oh. I just had to get over myself. I had to stop working with the equation that wanting slash having money equals greedy scumbag. And I had to get a freaking plan. First rule of wealth consciousness. Come from a place of abundance, not lack. When we say we want money for something, we often come from a place of, I don't have it, it does not exist, so I need to create it. This has us focusing on and believing in lack, thereby lowering our frequency and attracting more lack. When we say, I am manifesting $5,000 to go on a trip to Italy, you just watch me, our faith in the yet unseen is strong and our frequency is high. Thus, so is our ability to attract money. This is why buying the car worked so well for me. It forced me to face my fears and strengthen my faith because I bought it before I had the proof that the money was there. I don't see the money, but I believe it's there and it will be mine, damn it. This abundance is available to everyone, including you, regardless of what your life looks like at this very moment. Some people are born into cushy lives full of trust funds and connections and opportunities and fancy educations. Some of these people go on to make great financial successes of their lives, and some of these people don't. Some people are born into extreme poverty and live in cardboard box houses by the side of a freeway. Some of these people go on to make great financial successes of their lives, and some of these people don't. While their obstacles and initial childhood impressions about money can be extremely different, those who achieve success share one key thing: the belief that they can be, do, and have whatever they set their minds to accomplishing. Your beliefs hold the key to your financial success. Believe that you can have what you desire, that it really truly already exists, and then go out and get it. Once you understand that we live in an abundant universe, you can also drop the limiting belief that you serve the world better by not taking too much for yourself or by getting too big. Your playing small simply withholds your gifts from the people who are meant to receive them, including you. Can you imagine if your favorite musicians never let themselves make enough money to buy guitars or take lessons or hire producers or buy purple platform boots and tight sparkly pants or pay thousands of dollars for studio time so they could record the songs that saved your ass in high school? Or if the people who build airplanes refuse to make the money they need to pay for the research and the materials and the factories and the engineers and the electricity and whatever plethora of other costly things that go into building the miraculous flying machines that allow us to travel the world, hang out on tropical beaches, and visit the people we love so dearly? The more you have, the more you have to share. There's plenty of money to go around. You not letting yourself make it doesn't save more for other people, just as you making it doesn't take it away from them. The only reason you should feel gross about accepting money for a product or a service is if you're scamming someone, not doing or giving them what you said you would, or if you're causing harm in some other way. It's all about contributing to the world by making life easier, happier, safer, healthier, better, tastier, more beautiful, more fun, more interesting, more thoughtful, more loving. Whatever you do, bring something good to the party. If you're coming from a place of integrity, any icky feelings you have about not deserving the wealth you desire are a waste of time, just as any icky feelings you have about money itself are a waste of time. Greedy people do greedy things for money, so don't go getting all up in money's face and blame it for their lousy behavior. Here's a brilliant little spanking in this department from author-speaker Marianne Williamson that I recently heard in a talk she gave. Having money is like anything else, a tool. And if you see it that way, making it not just about you, but about a way that you can play a part in the dynamic by which money is used for the betterment of all things, then having money is not only a blessing, it's a responsibility. Having money is a responsibility. Let your inner money critic chew on that one for a while, okay? Second rule of wealth consciousness. Get clear on where you're at. Write a little ditty about how you feel about money. Get clear on all your craziness around it because trust me, if you don't have any money, you definitely have some crazy. Write something along the lines of, "So the truth is, I don't really trust money. I want lots of it so I can do whatever I want and make big changes in the world, but I don't believe it'll come to me. Or that if it does, it won't stick around. It never has. I resent needing it. I think people who make it are evil and have bad priorities. I ignore it because I hate dealing with it. I wouldn't know what to do with it if I made it anyway." If it's easier, pretend money is a person and write it as if you're writing a letter to someone. Just get it on the page so you can look at it. Then break it down, sentence by sentence, and expose your drama around money for the award-winning performance that it is. For example, "I don't believe money will come to me." Has it ever? I guess so. Can you imagine a specific time and a specific amount that came to you that was really helpful and enjoyable? Yes. I was a graphic designer for 5 years. I got to work on a lot of really cool projects with great people, making good money. Any other times? Have you had other jobs or monetary gifts or dividends? Yes. Can you list off 5 to 10 significant times that money came to you? Okay. So if it came to you all these many times, is it possible that it could come to you again? Yeah. Can you change your belief from "money doesn't come to me" to "money does come to me"? Fine. Yes, I can. Now that you see the truth, focus on money coming to you. Imagine receiving all the money you need, visualize how you'll spend it, and feel it in your bones. Change your story from "money doesn't come to me" to "money comes to me all the time." Make this an affirmation that you walk around saying in your mind out loud, that you write down, read over and over, and tape to your bathroom mirror. Drill it into your brain and your bones. Another example. "I resent needing it." How come? "Because I never have enough to do what I want." Is this true? Have you ever had enough money to do what you want? Well, there have been some times where I've had the money. So is it true that you never have enough money to do what you want? No. And when you have the money you need to do what you want, do you resent needing it? Not really. How does it feel when you have it and you spend it on something you're really excited about buying for you or someone else? Pretty cool, actually. So is it true you resent needing it? No. Once you've caught yourself in your big fat lie, focus on what it would feel like to spend money lavishly on yourself or the people you love or a cause you're passionate about or whatever, and really feel it in your bones. Imagine receiving it and feel yourself filling up with gratitude for it coming to you. Be grateful to money for the awesome tool it is and for allowing you to feel so good. Replace the story, "I resent needing money," with "I'm grateful to money for helping me live such an awesome life." Start healing your relationship with money. Sit your broke ass down and write a letter to money and then break it down sentence by sentence like I just did. Really do this, please, and create some new money affirmations. Repeat your new affirmations and feel them in your bones. Walk around thinking about how much you love, love, love money. Did hearing that just make you throw up a little bit in your mouth? You're going against some seriously deeply ingrained beliefs here. Money is incredibly loaded for most people. So if you want to get over your issues and start making money, spend some time on this. You are rewriting a story that was written in blood by you and generations before you, that you've been buying into your whole life. So it's going to take some effort to rewrite it and start living it. Third rule of wealth consciousness. Get clear on where you desire to be. We all need money. We need it to feed ourselves, buy clothes, get shelter, water, medicine, etc. Once it goes beyond basic survival, however, and we get into the arena of how much money we quote-unquote need, if we've got guilt and judgment and terror over what it means to have it, and what people will think of us if we do, this is where all hell is going to break loose. Of course, none of us need more than the basics to survive. But if we're talking about blossoming into the fullest expressions of our best selves in an abundant universe, we do. Which is why I'm assuming you're listening to this book instead of one on how to distinguish edible berries from poisonous ones. You don't want to merely survive, you want to thrive in every area of your life, including the area of financial support. Being wealthy means having the resources to provide yourself with everything you need and desire to share your gifts with the world as your biggest, badassiest self. This means being wealthy psychologically, spiritually, and energetically, as well as materially. Let's say you've got your own clothing company. You need money to have a space to create your designs. You need to pay for materials, manufacturing, shipping, payroll, marketing, and all the other expenses of running your business. That's obvious. But you also need to feel healthy, happy, and good so you can do your best work and bring the most awesome products to your customers. Maybe you need to live and work in a place you love that inspires you, or hire assistants so you're not exhausted and spread thin, or do things that fill you with happiness like travel and buy your friends dinner, or join a gym, or get a puppy, or buy clown noses for everyone in your office. Maybe you want to give 20% of your income to help drill water wells in Africa, as well as hire more staff so you can donate some time to doing charity work. It all counts. Feeling like you don't deserve the things that make you the happiest and best version of yourself because it's greedy or is asking too much ultimately rips off the rest of the world because you aren't being fully supported and, as a result, aren't sharing your highest frequency with the world. Be your best, do your best, demand the best, expect the best, receive the best, and put your best out into the world so everyone can receive your best too. Think of it this way. Would you rather hang out in a world where everyone feels happy and well taken care of and aspires to be the best they can be? Or would you rather be in a world where people live in fear and shame and scrimp and hold themselves back? What would each scenario do to your energy? One of the best things you can do to improve the world is to improve yourself. It's a grassroots effort. So if you need money to improve your life, get over it already and go get yourself some. Because this isn't just about you, okay? In order to go get some money, get very clear on what kind of life will make you truly happy. And be honest. What kind of experiences and possessions will support you in the work you want to do and in the kind of life you'd love to live? If you're truly happy living a simple life in a yurt, surrounded by people you love, trading little trinkets you've carved out of cow bones for food, and making just enough to get by, that's one thing. But pretending you don't want more than you already have because you can't afford it or feel guilty and pretentious for wanting it, that's another. That is called being a weenie. Determine what your personal, truest version of success looks like. No comparing yourself to others, please. Figure out how much it will cost, and then set out with steadfast determination to manifest the money you need to create it. Fourth rule of wealth consciousness: raise your frequency. Money on its own means nothing. A $100 bill sitting on a table is a piece of paper. It's the energy around it that makes it relevant. That $100 bill could have been slipped into a birthday card from your granny, or you could have stolen it from your best friend when she wasn't looking, or you could have earned it by doing something you loved or by doing something you hated. In each situation, the energy around the money is different. Nothing has any value other than the value we put on it. Similarly, the monetary value we put on things and services has energy. Someone could sell a t-shirt in a store for $10. Another person can sell the exact same t-shirt in some fancy store for $1,000. How much is a gold watch worth? How much is a broken watch worth that was owned by Michael Jackson? It's all make-believe. Or rather, it's all what we make ourselves believe. If we believe we're worth $10 an hour, that's the frequency we'll put out, and that's the kind of client or job we'll attract. If we believe we're worth $1,000 an hour, that's the frequency we'll put out, and that's the kind of client or employment opportunities we'll attract. The key word is believe. You can't be shitting bricks and charging more than you believe you're worth and expect to receive it, and you can't charge less than you believe you're worth and expect to flourish because you'll be pissed off. In order to create wealth, You must bring yourself into energetic alignment with the money you desire to manifest. Three people can do the same thing for a living. Let's say they're chiropractors, for example. One makes $50,000 a year, one makes $100,000 a year, one makes $1 million a year. Is the guy who makes $1 million that much better than the guy who makes $50,000? And how do you put a price tag on his betterness? Is the way he cracks someone's back $950,000 a year times better than the guy who makes $50,000? He may be more skilled or have more experience, but then again, he may not. But what it ultimately comes down to is his decision of his worth. He's operating at a $1 million frequency, so that's what he's charging and getting. Money is an exchange of energy between people. When you charge your clients from a certain frequency or demand a certain salary, you attract clients and employers who are already at that frequency. You're not putting a gun to their heads. You are not the only person offering these goods and services. They're free to work with or hire someone who's at a different frequency than you are, but they're coming to you. And part of what you offer is the opportunity to meet at your frequency. Lowering your frequency out of fear leaves everyone vibrating at a lower frequency. If it's important to you to offer your services for free or rock-bottom prices for people in serious deep doo-doo, then you can have a charitable leg of your business or some sort of scholarship dealio, or find a patron, or get grants, or seek another means of income that sustains you while you work for free. But exhausting yourself because you need to work 8 million hours in order to survive because you feel guilty charging what you're worth is real low-level stuff. You ultimately wind up helping fewer people because you're tired and crabby and less effective. So where are you at energetically with what you make? And where do you want to be? You can figure this out by getting nice and clear on the kind of life you desire to live, figuring out what you need to be making to manifest this reality, and set about matching your frequency to your desired income. If you're nowhere near where you want to be, keep pushing yourself to raise your prices or seek higher paying jobs. Surround yourself with higher frequency experiences and people. Beef up your education and know-how. Make vision boards of what you want your life to look like. Again, raising your frequency is like developing a muscle. Strengthening it is a process. Fifth rule of wealth consciousness: stay in shape. You must keep your frequency high and your belief in limitless possibility strong to manifest your dream house or your goal of going to the Olympics or to call in your soulmate. Otherwise, you run the risk of sliding backwards into having your father's lame relationship with money or your mother's terror of being visible or your divorced parents' mistrust of intimacy. When it comes to being mighty about money, one of the best ways to do this is to read wealth consciousness books all the time, over and over. My two staples have always been Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill and The Science of Getting Rich by Wallace Wattles, but there are plenty of others out there. Find some that work for you and read them for at least 30 minutes every single day. Surround yourself with inspiring people who don't think money is bad and those who either already have it or are intent on making it. Watch your thoughts and your words. Make a conscious effort to keep your positive financial mindset strong and unwavering. Get into reality about how much you want to make and why. There are countless ways to make serious money, and depending on what business you're in, they will obviously vary, but there are some general rules that apply across the board. Start by thinking about the life you'd love to live and why. Figure out exactly how much money you need to manifest to make it happen. If you don't know how much it would cost to build your dream house, do the research. If you want to travel, figure out where and by when and do the math on exactly how much it'll all cost. If you want a lifestyle where you eat out more and wear nicer clothes, crunch the numbers. How much money do you now need to make per year? Per month? Per hour? The universe responds to details. The universe responds to energy. The universe responds to badasses. There's a big difference between walking around saying you want to make $1 million a year and having crystal clear intentions, fierce desire, and hell-bent action towards specific goals. Make a list. Be super specific about exactly what it is, how much it will cost, why you want it, how it will make you feel, etc. You need to be in a full-on lather about it and want it so badly that it is not negotiable. It will and it must happen regardless of how long it takes. Decide what it is you want and write down the exact cost. Make it urgent. Ever notice how when your rent's due in a week and you have no idea how you're going to pay it? Or if you really need a specific amount of money for a specific urgent purpose, like getting a throbber of a rotten tooth pulled, that you always manage to somehow figure out how to get the money you need just in time? Usually, a check that you had forgotten about arrives in the mail, or an unexpected freelance job comes in, or you suddenly develop the nerve to ask someone for a loan, or you sell grandma's jewelry, or you compete with the 5-year-old selling lemonade down the street and make a killing. You shift from wasting your time whining and worrying because you're suddenly too busy making it happen. This is the power of clarity, urgency, not screwing around. The money is there if you really, truly desire it. It's just a matter of being so serious about it that you don't stray from the path of manifesting it, no matter what gets thrown in it. The trick is to treat your dreams with this same urgency and determination. It's one thing to kick ass when your back is against the wall and you've got to come up with your kids' tuition, and quite another to create self-imposed urgency so you stay the course until you've created your dream life instead of settling back into the big snooze. You need a sense of urgency to keep from dropping the ball when it gets difficult and sliding down into thinking, "Ah, screw it, I'm fine living next door to a kennel full of barking dogs. It's nothing getting some earplugs and boarding up my windows can't fix." Instead of being in reaction mode, it's about being in action mode. It's about no longer acting like a victim, letting your circumstances control your life, and instead acting like a superhero, creating a life that has you waking up in giddy disbelief that you get to be you. A great way to psych yourself into upgrading your life is by raising your bottom line. So often we take the massive leaps of faith only when we have to, when we need to put out some sort of fire, aka pay off some huge bill. Because this is about changing you, not just about changing your income, why not decide to be the kind of person who always has a certain amount of money in the bank? Be someone who's not in struggle and panic and constantly behind the eight ball. Come up with a figure and decide your account will never go below it. Make it non-negotiable. For example, if you decide that you will always have $2,000 in your checking account and refuse to see your balance go under it, it will light the fire under your ass to generate income the second you get close to dipping below it. Or decide that you will always donate 10% of what you make to charity, no matter what. Make a new bottom line. Get yourself out of struggle by changing your mindset and being conscious of how you deal with, generate, and receive your money. Envision yourself with this money and the specific things and/or experiences it's going to provide. As I said, money on its own means nothing. It's what we attach to it that gives it meaning and inspires us to have it in our lives. It's what this money makes us feel like that puts us in the proper tizzy to manifest it. Write a mantra that you can run over and over in your mind to help you manifest the money you desire. I see myself making $150,000 by December 31st by being an accountant and serving 30 new clients in the best way possible. I'm so grateful for this $150,000 by December 31st that allows me to take my family on a vacation to Bali and renovate our kitchen and donate money to build schools in Kenya. I see myself in the jungle with my kids and my wife. We're staying at my favorite hotel in Ubud. I feel so happy for being able to give my children this incredible, life-changing experience and for bringing my wife such joy. I can also see the kitchen and how happy it's made my wife to finally have it. I see the faces of the kids in Kenya as they write on the chalkboard in the school I've helped pay for. I feel such joy from being able to make a difference in their lives. I'm so grateful for this $150,000 that I will make by December 31st. I see the awesome clients I get to work with who are more than happy to pay me $100 an hour for my services. This money is mine. It is on its way to me now. I see it in my bank account, and I am so grateful for it. Write one that makes you feel invincible. Read it over and over every day. See it and feel it and become a crazy person about it. I know this sounds like a pain in the ass, but do it anyway, because trust me, it works. Lame, vague goals are the best way to live a lame, vague life. If you want to knock it out of the park, you need to know exactly what you're shooting for, and be so excited about it that you're almost annoying to yourself. Take hell-bent for glory action. Do every single thing you can think of to manifest this money/new lifestyle. If you got your own business, what new programs could you offer or what new products could you sell? Can you raise your prices, leverage your time, sign on bigger and fancier clients, sell more to the clients you already have, pick up a part-time job? If you work for someone else, ask for a raise or look for a new job that pays more. Listen to everyone around you with new ears. Is there an opportunity for a new, better-paying situation there that you may have not noticed before? Is there a position you can create or suggest that would get you at your desired income level? Continue to do everything humanly possible to magnetize it to you, and then surrender to the universe and be on the lookout for something unexpected to come in. An inheritance, someone who wants to pay you for your expertise, a brilliant idea that you'd normally pass over as too out of the question, or a conversation between two people looking for someone just like you to help redesign their new offices. Look for some opportunity or person to make an appearance that's not in your usual path of income. You are leaping into a new reality here. It's not your job to know the how. It's your job to ask for what you want and wait to discover the how. Then take action. When the unexpected money or the new job or the big client comes in is up to the universe. It can literally happen immediately or it can take years. Your job is to do everything you can to manifest it and have unshakable faith that the universe is moving it towards you in perfect timing. Get mentoring. Surround yourself with people who know more than you do. Read about them, study them, hang out with them, and hire them. Be on the lookout for the perfect coach or mentor or book or seminar, because when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Pay attention to who and what flies in your radar and learn as much as you can from them. Love yourself, and you will have it all. Chapter 25. Remember to surrender. Surrender to what is. Say yes to life, and see how life suddenly starts working for you rather than against you. Eckhart Tolle, author, channeler, high priest of being present. Imagine yourself sitting by a window, looking out at a garden on a lovely spring day. You see birds and bees and butterflies merrily flitting about, when all of a sudden, the most beautiful butterfly in the world catches your eye. Its stunning turquoise wings make your heart explode, its joyful flight makes your soul sing, its metamorphosis from wet, wormy thing to creature of soaring beauty fills you with inspiration. Suddenly you leap up, overcome and crazed with a fierce desire. It must be mine, mine, mine! You sprint to the closet, grab your net, sneak outside, and tiptoe through the tulips, stalking your beloved prey, all senses alert, focused, determined, tenacious, swinging your net over your head as you chase your butterfly around the garden. You chase it for hours and hours, but all you seem to do is scare it off rather than catch it. It's only when you stop trying so desperately, relax, breathe, and surrender your desire to the universe, that the butterfly of your dreams calmly comes and lands on your nose. When we want something so, so badly, and are working tirelessly to get it, if we don't surrender, we end up pushing it away instead. There comes a point where we need to hand the job over to the universe. This doesn't mean that we give up or discontinue taking action. This means we let it go energetically, release our kung fu grip, and create some space for what we want to come to us. It's about allowing instead of forcing. It's about releasing and trusting that if it's in alignment with our life's purpose, it will come back to us, or that something or someone even more perfect will come in its place. It's about surrendering and letting the universe do its thing while holding faith that our highest desire will come into our lives. Your faith in the universe must be stronger than your fear of not getting what you want. It's like hiring someone to clean your house so you can focus on the other work you enjoy doing. You explain in detail what they're supposed to do, show them where the broom is, tell them you'll beat them to death if they break the ceramic mugs your niece made for you, but you trust them with the job. If you're constantly hovering over them and grabbing the sponge out of their hands, "Here, let me do that," They'll never get their work done, and you'll stay in overwhelmed struggle, preventing yourself from reaping the benefits that inspired you to hire your cleaning crew in the first place. Surrendering is the part where you hand the job over to the universe. What often happens is that, regardless of our best intentions and hard work, we're trying to control our circumstances by using our limiting beliefs and old patterns. We think that we need to try and take charge of the situation, fear-based thinking, instead of having faith and gratitude and allowing the universe to deliver, love-based thinking. In short, we think we can do a better job of manifesting than the universe can. Imagine that someone invites you to a party. They're all excited about their big old rager, are fully certain that it's going to be awesome, and are truly delighted by the thought of having you come. They extend the invite with much glee and merriment and a deep desire to see you there, but with zero pressure. They know if you come, it will be awesome. They know if you don't come, it will be awesome. Their party is going to rock. They believe this in their hearts. It is the truth. Now imagine that someone else invites you to a different party. This person demands that you come, acts like their party will be a gigantic failure unless you show up, and reminds you that they came to your last party, so you have to come to theirs. They are whiny, manipulative, controlling, a big fat drag. They know they can have an awesome party, and really believe they can, but have decided that it all depends on you coming. Both people can do the exact same things to prepare. Decorate their houses, buy the cheese plates, get the booze, order the ice sculptures. But one person is much more likely to manifest what they want, you showing up and actually wanting to be there, than the other, because they have surrendered. Surrendering isn't about what you do, but who you are being as you do it. Your life is your party. You get to choose how you invite people and experiences and things into it. If you're broke as a joke, it's not about working until you're half dead to make ends meet and whining about your pathetic situation. It's about showing up every day with an excellent attitude, doing your best, leaning back, celebrating what is, and steadily working with the grateful expectation and belief that the universe is sending you a new, more lucrative opportunity. If you're single, it's not about boo-hooing the fact that you can't find someone good or half-heartedly forcing yourself to go on a million dates. It's about keeping your desire strong and your faith unwavering, brushing your hair and your teeth, leaving the house, flirting your ass off, joyfully going about your life and being grateful that not only is the person you're seeking also seeking you, but that the universe is conspiring to bring you together. Doubt is resistance. Faith is surrender. Worry is resistance. Joy is surrender. Control is resistance. Allowing is surrender. Ridicule is resistance. Believing is surrender. Energy needs to flow or else it stagnates. Surrendering puts you in the flow. Not only does surrendering create the space to manifest your desires, but it opens you up to manifest good-feeling experiences and things that are presently outside your realm of awareness, aka miracles. As I mentioned before, when you're moving into a new, awesome life that you've never lived in before, you can't expect to know how to get there because it's new territory. So you can only do that which you already know how to do and stay open to discovering the new how. Likewise, you need to be open to the fact that you may not know exactly what your new reality will look like because you've never seen it before. You're only able to envision that which is already known to you, so the mind-bogglingly awesome new life may be out of your scope of imagination, and by stubbornly holding on to the exact vision of what you want instead of surrendering, you set yourself up to miss out entirely on the very thing you're looking for. Sometimes your new reality will look just as you pictured it, sometimes totally different, and way better. Here's the basic breakdown on how to surrender. Get crystal clear on what you desire to manifest. See it, feel it, taste it, fall in love with it, believe it is already here. Decide you will have it. Inform the universe of your intention by behaving and thinking as if you already have it. Meditate, connect with infinite possibility, your intuition, and source energy. Take hell-bent, joyful, passion-fueled action. Be grateful that it's yours, that it's already here. Breathe. Let it go. Let it in. When you believe that everything you desire already exists, you are in a natural state of surrender. Surrendering is the free falling backwards into the unknown and trusting that the universe will catch you. And this can't be done from a place of lack or a place of mistrust. Okay, I'm releasing. You better come through, biatch! You have to give it all you've got and totally let it go for reals. You must fall back, have faith, be grateful, and wait. And while you're at it, love yourself, and the Mother Lode shall bestow her magic upon you. Chapter 26, Doing versus Spewing. God will not have his work made manifest by cowards. Ralph Waldo Emerson, fearless writer and poet, highly skilled spewer and doer. I have a friend who had the word, duh, tattooed on the inside of her upper arm in homage to the fact that all of our big aha moments are no-brainers. Fear is a choice. I am lovable. Don't worry. Be happy. Every time she high-fives or lifts her arm to see if she needs a shave, she gets reminded of how often the sublime lies waiting in the obvious. You know countless of these truisms of which I speak. You've heard them or thought them a million times, but when they finally sink in and you get it, they suddenly become earth-shattering news. An epiphany is a visceral understanding of something you already know. Once something moves from our brains to our bones, that's when we can use it to change our lives. The million-dollar question is, will we? Oh, the years people spend talking the talk, rolling out the shoulds, woulds, and coulds, attending the classes, trolling the seminar circuit, and burying themselves in all sorts of shelf-helpery before they finally, if ever, do anything with it all. There's a statistic that says that only 5% of people who sign up for something, like a course or a seminar, actually do anything with it. And this includes very, very high-priced somethings, not just the money management class at the community college down the road. This is because lots of people wish for change, really, really want it, are willing to invest the time and the money into it, but are ultimately not willing to get uncomfortable enough to actually make anything happen, which means they don't want it as badly as they say they do. I tried is the poor man's I kicked butt. People who are successful are not only willing to get uncomfortable, but they know they have to make a habit of it if they want to stay successful. They keep moving through each new challenge instead of stagnating and settling. The muscle of ass-kickery is like any other muscle. You have to use it or lose it. If you have one big breakthrough and feel like, I got this, I am on it, and then sit back and wait for your long overdue stream of awesomeness to keep pouring in, you will lose your muscle mass and fall back to the marshmallow state that you were in before you started working out. Keep moving, keep growing, keep pushing through obstacles, keep evolving. You break through at one level, arrive at the next, and take another step up. Each time you grow, you get to learn something new, which basically means you have to get uncomfortable again. Because when you arrive at a level you've never been at before, you're faced with challenges you've never experienced before. It's the willingness to keep pushing through new challenges, not shrink back from them into your comfort zone, that separates the successful from the unsuccessful. New level, new devil. All life is either moving forward and evolving or shrinking back and dying. If you want to evolve in your own life, you have to push through the obstacles instead of running from them. Obstacles and challenges are the agents of growth. Nobody gets to be large and in charge without facing challenges and moving through them. Birth is messy, painful, scary, uncertain, and freaky. Birth is also a glorious miracle that leads to new life. If you want the new life you say you want, you have to do the work instead of just studying and discussing and wishing and wanting. I recently had a real wake-up call in this department that I'll share with you in hopes that it'll inspire you to do the work and keep the faith no matter what. At the moment, I don't live anywhere, or I guess you could say I live everywhere. I got rid of my place 2 years ago and have been exploring the world indefinitely ever since. I've always loved traveling, And since all I need to run my business is my computer, a strong internet connection, good cell phone reception, and a sandwich, I decided to put all my things into storage and go for it. I saw this as a chance to walk my talk of living life on your own terms, to be the priestess of high vibe, to quantum leapfrog around the globe, to see in how many different languages I can learn how to say, "Would you mind watching my stuff while I go to the bathroom?" My main focus at the moment is mastering surrender. I want to have unshakable faith in the not yet seen. I want to get so comfortable trusting the universe that it becomes second nature and I can just leap into the void with toes pointed and daisy petals in my wake. Or, you know, at least do it with more grace and ease, especially now that I'm traipsing around the world loftily preaching about decision this and let it go that. I, too, would very much like to do instead of spew. Surrender comes into play often, especially when it comes to figuring out where I'm off to next and where I'm going to stay once I get there. My modus operandi is to go with the flow and trust that the universe will guide me to the perfect place at the perfect time, which, I'm quite pleased to report, has yet to disappoint. After following my sudden and bizarre impulse to go to Tokyo, a city I had zero interest in checking out, I not only fell in love with the place, but the ideal furnished apartment came up for rent and was handed to me on a silver platter when I decided I wanted to live there for a while. An invitation to stay in a gorgeous guest house in the Spanish countryside with great friends came in unsolicited and out of the blue when I was trying and failing to figure out where to go next. I keep finding myself repeatedly and fully coincidentally crossing paths in distant corners of the world with several of my fellow global nomads whom I met and befriended in Bali and who have me drop-jawed and giddy every time I bump into them. You're in a tiny remote fishing village wearing nothing but a sarong and a frizzy hairdo in the middle of nowhere Indonesia too? Yet even though my cosmic travel agent has more than proven that she knows exactly what she's doing, I was still fairly nervous about this last free fall. Because this time it wasn't all, "Just send me anywhere that seems cool where awesome things will happen to me, okay? Thanks!" I needed to land in the perfect place to write this book. I only had a month left before it was due to the publisher, and I had quite a bit of it left to write, so I was a tad uptight about the wheres and the whats and the hows. I was in Tokyo at the time, and my plan was to fly to LA to meet with a client, then road trip through the American West and wind up at some fabulous, fully furnished luxury rental home with a great view and lots of sunshine where I could concentrate and get lots of work done. I imagined being surrounded by awe-inspiring nature, but being close enough to a city where some friends lived in order to avoid the isolation best known for driving writers to drink heavily, or, in my case, to delve into failed experiments with cutting my own hair. If there were animals around to keep me company, that would be the cherry on top, but the rest was non-negotiable. About 2 weeks before leaving, I went online and started searching for houses to rent. I looked in every state west of Colorado, but everything I liked was booked. I asked everyone I knew and everyone I didn't know if they had any ideas. I sent out emails, Facebooked, tweeted, and texted, but again, nothing. There was always the hotel option, but I really had my heart set on a house, and I was starting to panic about the fact that I'd waited until the last minute. This was a big deal. This was my book. I needed inspiration and high frequency. I wanted to look up from my desk and gaze out the window upon an awe-inspiring view of mountains or ocean or rolling fields. Meanwhile, if something didn't come through soon, I was going to be gazing out the window of the bedroom I grew up in upon my mother sweeping the driveway in her slippers. I began resigning myself to the fact that I'd blown it. Instead of having faith in the universe and joyously anticipating the manifestation of my dream home, I started shrinking and talking myself into taking what I could get. What am I whining about? I'm lucky to have my mom's house to go to. I love her. Plus, she'll feed me lasagna while I'm writing. Then I realized what I was doing. What kind of hypocrite would I be if I got all fearful, small-minded, and low-vibe about where to write my book about how to not go through life fearful, small-minded, and low-vibe? You have to keep the faith, always, even when your ass is on the line. So, 48 hours before my flight left Tokyo for LA, I calmly sat back, focused on my ideal writing place, envisioned the wide open space it looked out upon, luxuriated in its plush couches and big open kitchen, soaked up the sun pouring in through its huge windows, felt it in my bones, believed it was real, did the whole wickety-woo thing, and got all excited and grateful that it already existed and was on its way to me. Then I sent out one more mass email asking if anyone knew of a great place for me to write my book, surrendered it up to the universe, and took myself out for a big fat sushi dinner to celebrate the awesome writing paradise that was about to land in my lap. When I returned to my hotel, there was an email waiting for me from a friend who knew some people who had a place I could move into ASAP. I'm pleased to report that I'm writing this in a big, luxurious, open, sunny, magnificent house with huge windows and spectacular views an hour outside of San Francisco, where five of my best friends from college live. The house is on top of a hill overlooking 17 acres of rolling farmland, and I can stay for as long as I want, as long as I take care of their adorable horse and two goats. This shit works. So, how serious are you about not settling? You can make a quantum leap in your life right now. You can change your entire reality on a dime if you want to badly enough, or massively increase your income level, or drop 10 pounds, or begin waking up excited to be who you are instead of merely putting up with your day until it's cocktail hour. Whatever level of upgrade you want, it's available to you right now. You just have to decide to make it happen, to be engaged with your life, and let the universe work for you. Here are some ways to take what you've learned in this book and seal the deal. 1. Give your bad habits the heave-ho. Successful people have good habits. Unsuccessful people have losery habits. Because our habits are all the things that we do automatically, without thinking, they help to define who we are. If you're in the habit of getting up and working out every morning, you're in shape. If you're in the habit of never doing what you say you're going to do, you're unreliable. And if you're in the habit of getting massages 3 times a week, you're really psyched. Pay attention to the areas of your life that you're not so thrilled about. Figure out which bad habits helped create them and trade those habits in for some good ones. Form the kind of habits that successful people have. Good time management habits, good decision-making habits, good thought habits, good health habits, good relationship habits, good work habits, etc. Think of what behaviors would make the biggest positive changes in your life, maybe even the kind of changes you can hardly imagine coming true, and set about turning them into habits. How do you form a habit? Decide to. Make it a part of your regular, everyday activities. Make it as non-negotiable and thoughtless as brushing your teeth or getting out of bed. Schedule it in. Work on uncovering your subconscious beliefs and rewriting your stories. And if it's something you've tried and tried to change on your own, get some help. Hire a coach, a mentor, a personal trainer. Tell a friend to spray paint "I'm a lazy lard ass" on the side of your house if you don't reach your goal of going to the gym 5 days a week. Whatever you have to do, start developing successful habits if you want to become a successful person. 2. Breathe amongst the people. Your superhero power, i.e. your connection to source energy, is available to you 24/7, not only when you're sitting cross-legged in your robe meditating. Once you get your brain used to shutting up and tuning into source energy, you can start doing it throughout your day. The whole point of everything you've learned in this book is to use it to improve your life, not to take a break, go off and read, and then head back out to live your life again and leave everything you've learned back there on the couch where you were reading. You want to carry all this stress-relieving, life-appreciating, joy-delivering, mood-lifting, source-connecting, butt-kicking benefits with you all day. And the best way to do this is through your breath. When you're stuck in traffic, getting yelled at by your boss, feeling awkward at a party, strolling through the office, lying on the beach, trying to remember how to get to your sister's house, take a moment to breathe deeply, clear your mind, check in with your bod, become present in the moment, and connect with source energy. The more of a habit you make this throughout your day, the more you will see profound, positive changes in your life, both emotionally and physically, and the more gracefully you will be able to deal with the next inconsiderate jerk who decides to yell into their cell phone while sitting next to you at a restaurant. 3. Hang high. Hang out with people who are kicking ass and who will make you feel like a giant loser if you're not kicking ass too. I obviously can't stress this enough. Who you surround yourself with greatly affects how you see your world and how high you set the bar for yourself. If you hang out with people who constantly whine about how tired, broke, and worried about the economy they are, You'll feel like a hero for just getting out of bed in the morning. Hang out with people who are living on purpose, who meet their challenges with a step aside, suckers, attitude, who are dating super awesome people, making exactly the kind of money they want to be making, or working towards it, or taking the kinds of vacations they and you want to be taking, and you'll not only see what's possible for you too, but you'll have more incentive to follow suit. 4. Set honest goals. Don't decide you're going to run 10 miles a day when you still consider walking to the pizza parlor around the corner a day's worth of exercise. Start with running half a mile a day and add more as you get stronger. Discipline is a muscle. You have to build it up at your own pace. If you bite off more than you can chew at the start, chances are excellent you'll get discouraged and give up altogether. Set honest goals that are just outside your comfort zone and build from there. 5. Read your manifesto. Write down your goals and your vision of your ideal life in the present tense and be as specific as possible. Where do you live? Who do you live with? What do you do for fun? Who are you surrounded by? How much money do you make? How do you make it? How do you want to give back to the world? What are you wearing? Etc. Make it so freaking awesome that you can't read it without weeping and wailing and putting it down to compose yourself every few sentences. Read it to yourself before you go to bed and when you wake up every single solitary day. I am so not kidding over here. Become obsessed with it. Think about how you're changing your life and who you're becoming and be in a state of giddy expectation about it as often as possible. The more you focus on who you're becoming and the more emotional you can get about it, the faster you will become it. 6. Get out your credit card and pay for some help already. Getting some coaching or mentoring is perhaps the fastest and best thing you can do to make a massive change in the shortest amount of time. I'm not, and I kind of am, just saying this because I'm a coach and have watched my clients do the impossible. I'm also saying it because I've been coached within an inch of my life and know how radically it's changed my world. Think about it. Professional athletes work with coaches their entire careers. They don't decide all of a sudden, alrighty, I just made $8 million hitting a ball around this year. I think I'm pretty well set to do it on my own. They continue to get coaching so they can stay at their peak level and keep growing. What makes you think you can do it all by yourself? Especially if you spent the majority of your life basically proving you can't. 7. Get your body in on it. Your mind will follow where your body leads. If you're in a bad mood and remember to stand up nice and tall and straight, your mood will automatically lift. And when you're in shape and have tons of energy, you feel like you can take over the world. If you're serious about getting your act together, stop being a lazy cow. Get the blood flowing, eat food that excites you and nourishes you, get your breathing deeper, use your mind, body, and soul together to make this thing happen for yourself. Advanced body option. Okay. So this is totally weird and won't go over well, but I'm going to give it to you anyway because it works. If you want to really get yourself rock solid and determined and pumped up, pound your chest and punch your fists in the air while you repeat your affirmations at the same time. Yell things like, I am powerful, I am confident, the universe has my back, and I am going to kick ass, or whatever your deal is in the affirmations department. Get your body engaged and anchor in the words physically, and your affirmations will have far greater power. The mind and the body are way more powerful together than either one is alone. 8. Use your secret weapons. Make a playlist of songs that gets you pumped up. Listen to motivational tapes. Surround yourself with pictures of people who think you're awesome. Wear clothes that make you feel sexy and smart. Dance, scream, pound your chest, go for a run while listening to the theme from Rocky. Figure out what makes you feel like you could carry a horse over your head and do it as often as possible. You're going for the gold here. You have to stay in the zone. 9. Love yourself with a kung fu grip. Chapter 27. Beam me up, Scotty. Nothing is impossible. The word itself says, I'm possible. Audrey Hepburn, actress, icon, fabulist. My grandmother on my mother's side lived to be 100 years old. Nana was as waspy as they make 'em. Prissy, reserved, able to avoid confrontation with the skilled precision of an F-16 pilot. For as long as I can remember, she always looked exactly the same. She was eternally adorned in a cardigan, pinned together at the top by an antique brooch, her pink lipstick and sparkly brown eyes shining through a face full of wrinkles that erupted in a series of, "Oh, dears," every time she laughed. In her long lifetime, Nana witnessed the birthing of such pivotal human achievements as the phone, the car, the TV, human flight, the computer, the internet, and rock and roll. The two things that blew her mind the most, however, were putting a man on the moon and the soda dispensers at McDonald's. She'd stand there watching, gripped by disbelief, as an employee placed a cup, small, medium, or large, beneath a spout, pushed a button, and walked away, leaving the machine to fill it up the perfect, proper amount. "How does it know where to stop?" Nana would shake her head, mortified. "How does it know?" After we figured out how to clone a sheep, she pretty much threw in the towel on ever questioning anything again. One day my family took her out for lunch to a restaurant on the top floor of some giant hotel. When we got into the elevator, someone accidentally pushed the button for the floor we were already on the moment the doors closed, making them open right back up again. Thinking we'd just gone up 45 flights in a split second, we watched my sweet little grandmother exit the elevator, nervously patting her hair as she wandered down the hallway muttering to herself, "Why not?" I want to sign off here by encouraging you to pursue your dreams with the same belief that anything is possible as a little old lady in knee-high stockings and sensible heels who was born in 1903 and lived through the most technologically flabbergasting century to date. Whatever you desire to do with your precious life, write jokes or rock out or start a business or learn to speak Greek or quit your job or raise a bunch of kids or fall in love or lose your flab, or open orphanages around the world, or direct movies, or save dolphins, or make millions, or live in a canyon in a loincloth, believe that it's possible, and that it's available to you, and that you deserve to be, do, and have it. Why not? Give yourself the permission and the means, yes, this includes the money, to be who you are, regardless of what anybody else thinks or believes is possible. Do not deny yourself the life you want to live because you're worried you're not good enough or that you'll be judged or that it's too risky. Because who does that benefit? No one, that's who. When you live your life doing the things that turn you on, that you're good at, that bring you joy, that make you shove stuff in people's faces and scream, "Check this out!" You walk around so lit up that you shoot sunbeams out your eyeballs, which automatically lights up the world around you, which is precisely why you are here. To shine your big-ass ball of fire onto this world of ours. A world that literally depends upon light to survive. You are powerful. You are loved. You are surrounded by miracles. Believe, really believe, that what you desire is here and available to you, and you can have it all. Love yourself. You are a badass. This concludes You Are a Badass by Jen Sincero. Narrated by Jen Sincero. Copyright 2013 by Jen Sincero. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Running Press, a member of the Perseus Books Group, and was produced in the year 2013 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com. for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call toll-free 877-7-T-A-N-T-O-R to request a catalog.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.